Welcome again. We pick up a new chapter this evening in the synthesis of yoga. The first section, the Yoga of Divine Works, this, chapter 4. The sacrifice, the triune path, and the Lord of the sacrifice, which when it appeared in the Arya was chapter 5 because they had forgotten a chapter, misplaced that. And it was called simply Sacrifice in the Triune Path. So you can see that Sri Aurobindo has grown the theme to incorporate the beginning, the middle, and the end of what the teaching of the Gita is. So there will be a number of references that we'll touch upon as we go through tonight. I think it's interesting to see how deeply versed Sri Aurobindo was in this. I don't mean to suggest that when he composed this either in the writing of the Arya or later when he revised everything, that he sat there with the Gita as a manual and flipped through and referred to pages. Rather, it was so much part of what was in his bloodstream that he could write about the Gita in a way that was conversational and yet be deeply referential and reverential towards it. The Gita, again, was one of the first things that he asked for when he was put in the Alipur jail by the British in 1909. So, chapter 4, the sacrifice, the triune path, and the Lord of the sacrifice, appearing first, 15 April 1915, and then subsequently revised. Strongly revised. The law of sacrifice is the common divine action that was thrown out into the world in its beginning as a symbol of the solidarity of the universe. So this is not spelled out, but this is a reference perhaps to the Rig Veda, to the Purusha Sukta in the Rig Veda. That's in the 10th mandala. It's the 90th hymn. But it also appears in the Shukla Yajur Veda and as well in the Atharva Veda. What it describes is the conscious, intentional sacrifice that the Supreme Person makes in order to establish all the universe, which is drawn from his own being. Now, Sri Aurobindo later, of course, interprets the creation of the universe as the holocaust of the Divine Mother. But in the Rig Veda, it is imaged as the Supreme Person, the Purusha, the Supreme Cosmic Being, who gives himself to the ordering of the universe and the ordering of the human society. The human society is also drawn from his being, so that all in the cosmos, all forms of life, every aspect of human development is appropriately placed in a kind of cosmic hierarchy, but a hierarchy that is nevertheless integrated into a whole. So there is no division, there is differentiation. So let's read that sentence again. The law of sacrifice is the common divine action that was thrown out into the world in its beginning as a symbol of the solidarity of the universe. So going down into the creation of the world, and then sacrifice is what sustains the world as it operates. It is by the attraction of this law that a divinizing principle, a saving power, descends to limit and correct and gradually to eliminate the errors of an egoistic and self-divided creation. It isn't that division is imposed upon us, it's that we in our ignorance and our egoism insist upon it. We can outgrow it. This descent, this sacrifice of the Purusha, the divine soul submitting itself to force and matter so that it may inform and illuminate them, is the seed of redemption of this world of inconscience and ignorance. This is not the only philosophy in which there is seen at the root of the cosmos something which has gone dark and contrary, but which can be redeemed and illuminated. This is an idea that peoples many of the world's visionary philosophies. Pardon me. So there may seem to be darkness and ignorance, but there will be light at the end of the cosmic journey. Not annihilation, not obliteration, not a blank zero at the end, but something which is fulfilling. For with sacrifice as their companion, says the Gita, the All-Father created these peoples. Prajapati. This is Bhagavad Gita, the third chapter, the 10th shloka. The acceptance of the law of sacrifice is a practical recognition by the ego that it is neither alone in the world nor chief in the world. It is its admission that even in this much fragmented existence, there is beyond itself and behind that which is not its own egoistic person, something greater and completer, a diviner all, which demands from it subordination and service. Indeed, sacrifice is imposed and, where need be, compelled by the universal world force. It takes it even from those who do not consciously recognize the law, inevitably, because this is the intrinsic nature of things. This goes back to the Gita again, the third chapter, the 5th shloka. The idea that the world, having been established on this principle of give and take, I give myself, and now you give yourself. It is compelled, whether we know it or not, from all of our action. The world is driven by a conscious will, which is invisible to ignorance, but which is discernible to the awakened eye and ear. Our ignorance, or our false egoistic view of life, can make no difference to this eternal bedrock truth of nature. For this is the truth in nature, that this ego, which thinks itself a separate, independent being, and claims to live for itself, is not and cannot be independent nor separate, nor can it live to itself even if it would. But rather, all are linked together by a secret oneness. There is this idea so current in recent innings of Western history that the individual is an atom, like a billiard ball, separate from all other billiard balls, and need not be associated, can withdraw, but this idea of being alone and alien is impossible. It's an egoistic fiction. It does not exist. You'll remember that in The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo goes so far in his thought to say that the individual has no separate existence. We speak of the three poises of the divine being. as a transcendent, as a universality, and as an individual. But the individual is always placed in the universality. Never is it possible for it to exist alone. It draws its truth from its context and is its happiest, is its most felicitous when it looks abroad and sees its fellow beings situated everywhere around it and discovers that the same essence is in all these, and that is the thing that unifies them. So the harmony is founded on an absolute identity. This secret oneness is discoverable and experienceable. Each existence is continually giving out perforce from its stock, out of its mental receipts from nature or its vital and physical assets and acquisitions and belongings. A stream goes to all that is around it. This is described again in the sixth chapter of the Gita, in verses 29 to 31, and then continuing on. So you see that the subtle suggestion is that the yoga that he's speaking about here is based on sacrifice, which is self-giving, which yokes us or hitches us again back into a felt connection in oneness with both the universe and the divine thatness which lies beyond it. He continues, and always, again, it receives something from its environment gratis or in return for its voluntary or involuntary tribute. For it is only by this giving and receiving that can affect its own growth, while at the same time it helps the sum of things. At length, though at first slowly and partially, we learn to make the conscious sacrifice. Even in the end, we take joy to give ourselves and what we envisage as belonging to us in a spirit of love and devotion to that which appears for the moment other than ourselves and is certainly other than our limited personalities. This again is chapter 6 in the Gita. The sacrifice and the divine return for our sacrifice then become a gladly accepted means towards our last perfection, for it is recognized now as the road to the fulfillment in us of the eternal purpose. This is again chapter 4, verse 24. Brahmarpanam brahmahabhi. The divine is the act of offering, the divine is the substance that is offered, etc., etc. One of the consummate voices heard in the Gita is in that shloka. But most often, the sacrifice is done unconsciously, egoistically, and without knowledge or acceptance of the true meaning of the great world rite. It is so that the vast majority of earth creatures do it, and when it is so done, the individual derives only a mechanical minimum of natural, inevitable profit, achieves by it only a slow, painful progress, limited and tortured by the smallness and suffering of the ego. Only when the heart, the will, and the mind of knowledge associate themselves with the law and gladly follow it, can there come the deep joy and the happy fruitfulness of divine sacrifice. The mind's knowledge of the law and the heart's gladness in it culminate in the perception that it is to our own self and spirit and the one self and spirit of all that we give. And this is true even when our self-offering is still to our fellow creatures or to lesser powers and principles and not yet to the Supreme. Not for the sake of the wife, says Yajnavalkya in the Upanishad, but for the sake of the self is the wife dear to us. And we've often spoken about this shloka from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. This, in the lower sense of the individual, self, is the hard fact behind the colored and passionate professions of egoistic love. But in a higher sense, it is the inner significance of that love too, which is not egoistic, but divine. All true love and all sacrifice are in their essence nature's contradiction of the primary egoism and its separative error. It is her attempt to turn from a necessary first fragmentation towards a recovered oneness. All unity between creatures is in its essence a self-finding, a fusion with that from which we have separated, a discovery of one's self in others. So the universe is a story of moving from self-imposed division to an all-according oneness and discovering that all comes from a single source. We have always been one, even in our rancor and our division, and we will always be one. But it is only a divine love and unity that can possess in the light what the human forms of these things seek for in the darkness. For the true unity is not merely an association and agglomeration like that of physical cells joined by a life of common interests. It is not even an emotional understanding, sympathy, solidarity, or close drawing together. Only then are we really unified with those separated from us by the divisions of nature, when we annul the division and find ourselves in that which seemed to us not ourselves. Association is a vital and physical unity. Its sacrifice is that of mutual aid and concessions. Nearness, sympathy, solidarity create a mental, moral, and emotional unity. Theirs is a sacrifice of mutual support and mutual gratifications. But the true unity is spiritual. Its sacrifice is a mutual self-giving, an interfusion of our inner substance. And this echoes what he wrote in The Life Divine, where he spoke about the movement in nature, especially through conscious humanity, from association to mutuality and eventually to harmony and oneness. The same thing is true here. It's just climbing in conscious evolution towards a rediscovering of our essential being. The law of sacrifice travels in nature towards its culmination in this complete and unreserved self-giving. It awakens the consciousness of one common self in the giver and the object of the sacrifice. This culmination of sacrifice is the height even of human love and devotion when it tries to become divine. For there too, the highest peak of love points into a heaven of complete mutual self-giving. Its summit is the rapturous fusing of two souls into one. you see this image even in the Rig Veda, when Kutsa, the aspiring human soul, becomes so strongly affined to the conscious power of the divine mind, who is Indra, that they rise together towards heaven and become so much one that none can distinguish the one from the other, except for Indrani, she who is the Shakti, the power of Indra. She only knows the difference. So much oneness has been achieved. So this is a very ancient idea. This profounder idea of the worldwide law is at the heart of the teaching about works given in the Gita. A spiritual union with the highest by sacrifice and unreserved self-giving to the eternal is the core of its doctrine. The vulgar conception of sacrifice is an act of painful self-immolation, austere self-mortification, difficult self-effacement. This kind of sacrifice may go even as far as self-mutilation and self-torture. And clearly we see in the history of spiritual effort many such austere movements which have claimed the attention of aspirants around the world. These things may be temporarily necessary in man's hard endeavor to exceed his natural self. If the egoism in his nature is violent and obstinate, it has to be met sometimes by an answering strong internal repression and counterbalancing violence. But the Gita discourages any excess of violence done to oneself. Chapter 16, Shloka 18. For the self within is really the Godhead evolving. It is Krishna. It is the divine. It has not to be troubled and tortured as the titans of the world trouble and torture it, but to be increased, fostered, cherished, luminously opened to a divine light and strength and joy and wideness. It is not one's self, but the band of the spirit's inner enemies that we have to discourage, expel, slay upon the altar of the growth of the spirit. These can be ruthlessly excised, whose names are desire, wrath, inequality, greed, attachment to outward pleasures and pains, the cohort of usurping demons that are the cause of the soul's errors and suffering. So all these, again, are psychologically fixed in us and can be unwound. Those knots can be loosened. These should be regarded not as part of oneself, but as intruders and perverters of ourselves' real and diviner nature. These have to be sacrificed in the harsher sense of the word, whatever pain and going they may throw by reflection on the consciousness of the seeker. But the true essence of sacrifice is not self-immolation. It is self-giving. Its object, not self-effacement, but self-fulfillment. Its method, not self-mortification, but a greater life. Not self-mutilation, but a transformation of our natural human parts into divine members. Not self-torture, but a passage from lesser satisfaction to a greater ananda. And let's go back to the idea that's at the heart of the Sanskrit term yajna, which is not the idea of sacrifice, something torn away from us, in a sense unwillingly, but something that is joyfully offered. There may be an accompanying sense of duty, but it's something that you want to give. It's an offering. It is a self-surrender. What you're offering represents you. In giving something precious to yourself, you're saying, this is an aspect of my being that I give to you. There is only one thing painful in the beginning to a raw or turbid part of the surface nature. It is the indispensable discipline demanded, the denial necessary for the merging of the incomplete ego. But for that, there can be a speedy and enormous compensation in the discovery of a real greater or ultimate completeness in others, in all things, in the cosmic oneness, in the freedom of the transcendent self and spirit, in the rapture of the touch of the divine. Our sacrifice is not a giving without any return or any fruitful acceptance from the other side. It is an interchange between the embodied soul and conscious nature in us and the eternal spirit. This goes back to chapter 4, shloka 24. Brahmarpanam brahmahavi. For even though no return is demanded, yet there is the knowledge deep within us that a marvelous return is inevitable. The soul knows that it does not give itself to God in vain. Claiming nothing, it yet receives the infinite riches of the divine power and presence. It knows because reciprocity is the nature of the divine movement. The circle. One rises with the offering, and that descends with a response. It is the very nature of the thing. From that to here, from the roots of the cosmos, which are fixed above with the branches extending downward, in all that we gather from that tree of life, we give back an offering to that, and it comes back to us again. And the circle is never broken. The soul knows that it does not give itself to God in vain, claiming nothing, it yet receives the infinite riches of the divine power and presence. Last, there is to be considered the recipient of the sacrifice and the manner of the sacrifice. The sacrifice may be offered to others, or it may be offered to divine powers. It may be offered to the cosmic all, or it may be offered to the transcendent supreme. This, again, the various verses, chapter 9, 915, 922 and on, or back to chapter 6, 29 through 31 and on. The worship given may take any shape, from the dedication of a leaf or flower, a cup of water, a handful of rice, a loaf of bread, to consecration of all that we possess and the submission of all that we are. This is beautifully expressed in the 9th chapter in the 26th shloka, 9:26. Whoever the recipient, whatever the gift, it is the supreme, the eternal in things, who receives and accepts it, even if it be rejected or ignored by the immediate recipient. For the supreme who transcends the universe is yet here too, however veiled in us and in the world and in its happenings. He is there as the omniscient witness and receiver of all our works and their secret master. All our actions, all our efforts, even our sins and stumblings and sufferings and struggles are obscurely or consciously known to us and seen or else unknown and in a disguise, governed in their last result by the One. All is turned towards Him in His numberless forms and offered through them to the single omnipresence. In whatever form and with whatever spirit we approach Him, in that form and with that spirit, He receives the sacrifice. And the fruit also of the sacrifice of works varies according to the work, according to the intention in the work, and according to the spirit that is behind the intention. But all other sacrifices are partial, egoistic, mixed, temporal, incomplete. Even those offered to the highest powers and principles keep this character. The result, too, is partial, limited, temporal, mixed in its reactions, effective only for a minor or intermediate purpose. The one entirely acceptable sacrifice is a last and highest and uttermost self-giving. It is that surrender made face to face with devotion and knowledge, freely and without any reserve, to One who is at once our immanent self, the environing constituent all, the supreme reality beyond this or any manifestation, and secretly, all these together, concealed everywhere, the immanent transcendence. For to the soul that wholly gives itself to Him, God also gives Himself altogether. Only the one who offers his whole nature finds the self. Only the one who can give everything enjoys the divine all everywhere. Only a supreme self-abandonment attains to the supreme. Only the sublimation by sacrifice of all that we are can enable us to embody the highest and live here in the immanent consciousness of the transcendent spirit. So this is all through the ninth chapter, 922, 927, 28, and 934. Become my minded, my lover and adorer, a sacrificer to me. So there in that ninth chapter, there's already the secret, the Trimarga, the triune path, the title of this chapter, my minded, one with that in knowledge, my lover and adorer, one with that in the rapture of love and ananda, a sacrificer to me, actively living out your knowledge in your action and giving all that you are, all that you touch, all that you experience to that. Knowledge, works, and love fused. Now you step towards perfection. We'll pause there and we'll continue in our chapter next time. Here is Here is a section from Savitri. This begins in Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, in Canto 3, the House of the Spirit in the New Creation, on page 318. A last and mightiest transformation came. His soul was all in front, like a great sea, flooding the mind and body with its waves. His being spread to embrace the universe, united the within and the without, to make of life a cosmic harmony, an empire of the immanent divine. In this tremendous universality, not only his soul nature and mind sense included every soul and mind in his, but even the life of flesh and nerve was changed and grew one flesh and nerve with all that lives. He felt the joy of others as his joy. He bore the grief of others as his grief. His universal sympathy upbore, immense like ocean, the creation's load, as earth upbears all beings' sacrifice, thrilled with the hidden transcendence, joy, and peace. There was no more division's endless scroll. One grew the spirit's secret unity. All nature felt again the single bliss. There was no cleavage between soul and soul. There was no barrier between world and God. Overpowered were form and memory's limiting line. The covering mind was seized and torn apart. It was dissolved, and now no more could be. The one consciousness that made the world was seen. All now was luminosity and force. Abolished in its last thin fainting trace, the circle of the little self was gone. The separate being could no more be felt. It disappeared and knew itself no more, lost in the spirit's wide identity. His nature grew a movement of the all, exploring itself to find that all was he. His soul was a delegation of the all that turned from itself to join the one supreme. Transcended was the human formula. Man's heart that had obscured the inviolable assumed the mighty beating of a god's. His seeking mind seized in the truth that knows. His life was a flow of the universal life. He stood fulfilled on the world's highest line, awaiting the ascent beyond the world, awaiting the descent the world to save. A splendor and a symbol wrapped the earth. Serene epiphanies looked, and hallowed vast surrounded, wise infinitudes were close, and bright remotenesses leaned near and kin. Sense failed in that tremendous lucency. Ephemeral voices from his hearing fell, and thought, potent no more, sank large and pale, like a tired god, into mysterious seas. The robes of mortal thinking were cast down, leaving his knowledge bare to absolute sight. Fate's driving ceased, and nature's sleepless spur. The athlete heavings of the will were stilled in the omnipotence, unmoving peace. Life in his members lay down vast and mute. Naked, unwalled, unterrified, it bore the immense regard of immortality. The last movement died, and all at once grew still. A weight that was the unseen transcendence hand laid on his limbs the spirit's measureless seal. Infinity swallowed him into shoreless trance. Namaste. Jai Mahal.